Section of
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer, sitting in for Mike Collins. As we enter the final week, yes, the final week of this year's midterm elections, one group is getting intense interest from candidates, campaigns, and the media alike: women voters. Among North Carolina's 6.6 million registered voters, 3.5 million are women, making up 53% of the eligible voters who can cast ballots. Nationally, women are also the majority of voters, and they have become a valuable part of any winning campaign strategy. Along with North Carolina Democrat Kay Hagan and South Carolina Republican Nikki Haley, women are on the ballot along with the issues designed to appeal to them. Joining us today is a panel of experts who have studied women and their voting trends. We'd like to hear from you as well if you are a female voter and if you're going to vote or not this year, and what are the issues that you are most interested in. Go to our Facebook page, send us a tweet at WFAE, or send us an email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Joining us by phone for today's show is Dr. Susan Carroll, who is a senior scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics, which is part of the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers, where she is also a professor of political science and women's and gender studies. She has published widely, including writing books entitled More Women Can Run, Gender and Pathways to the State Legislature, and Gender and Elections, Shaping the Future of American Politics. She joins us from her office at Rutgers. Good morning, Dr. Carroll.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Joining us here in the studio is Dr. Martha Croft, professor of political science and public administration at UNC Charlotte. She has researched a variety of election-related issues, such as provisional voting, how local election officials implement election policies, and voter turnout. The author of more than 20 research articles and book chapters, Martha has co-authored the book Helping America Vote: The Limits of Election Reform. Welcome back to the show, Martha.
Thank you, Michael.
And from Winthrop University is Dr. Karen Kodrowski, professor of political science and dean of Winthrop's College of Arts and Sciences. An expert in American politics, public policy, and women in politics, she is the author of numerous publications, including Breastfeeding Rights in the United States and Cancer Activism. She had previously served as chair of Winthrop's political science department and has been a visiting Fulbright chair as well. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning.
Joining us a bit later will be a member of the League of Women Voters of North Carolina to join us later in the show. But I wanted to start with kind of a big picture view. Women voters have certainly been the coveted prize for campaigns and candidates in the past several election cycles. Susan, what are we seeing nationally in the trends regarding the push to gain the female vote in this year's midterm elections?
Well, we're seeing that women are playing a very critical role. I mean, campaigns across the country are really courting women voters because they realize that women are going to be key to what happens in the midterm elections in a number of different states. So women are probably playing more of a role this year than they ever have, perhaps. And one of the issues is that there is a drop-off in voters between presidential elections and midterm elections. So a lot of the people who vote in the presidential election don't turn out to vote in on an election like this. And women in particular tend to drop off in fairly significant numbers. And the women who drop off tend to be more inclined to vote for Democratic candidates. So the Democrats very much are trying to mobilize women voters and try to get women voters to turn out. And of course, Republicans are trying to appeal to the women voters who are going to turn out and to turn out their base women voters as well.
Karen, how do you see this year's election shaping up?
I think Susan is exactly right. Women voters will remain important because they are the majority of the voters and they turn out in higher percentages. However, the demographics of the women who are going to turn out will mirror those of the demographics of the entire range of voters, in that they are going to be more affluent, more politically engaged, more educated, and more efficacious. And that means that they will trend more Republican than what you might see in a presidential election.
Okay. Martha?
Well, absolutely. I want to echo what Karen and Susan say and just say, generally speaking, this is going to be a turnout election. A lot of the ads that are on right now, I think, are really geared toward encouraging women to get out there and vote, right? They're not necessarily going to persuade women to vote one way or another. At least that would be what my research would indicate. Rather, it's more about mobilizing voters. Sort of taps into a debate that we political scientists have had for years and years and years. Do campaigns matter?
Right.
Absolutely, for voter turnout. And every vote counts for the Democrats and the Republicans.
Okay. We've got two high-profile women on the ballots, both here in North Carolina and in South Carolina. Susan, what's the feeling in terms of the big marquee races that involve women on the ballots across the country?
Well, they all seem to be very close. You know, they're it's interesting because I don't remember an election where we have had, certainly an off-year election, a midterm election, where we've had this many key races and really control of the U.S. Senate, in a sense, in races involving women candidates. So there are, you know, they're just almost every key race you can point to in the country, you know, whether it be, you know, North Carolina or New Hampshire or just a variety of races around the country. It's women candidates who are involved.
Do you know how many women candidates are on the ballot for seats in Congress, both in the House and in the Senate? Is that up this year in comparison to other years?
I don't have that number right in front of me, but I can get it for you in just a couple of minutes if you come back to me.
That's quite all right. Quite all right. In terms of looking at the potential increases in the competitiveness in terms of women candidates on the ballot, does it make a difference to have a female on the ballot in terms of will more women tend to show up if they are on the ballot, or do we know what that kind of potential turnout, if we're talking about a low voter turnout, which is typical in midterm elections, would the presence of a female on the ballot drive up the women's vote, or is it just kind of a wash?
That's a complicated, there's a complicated answer to that question, I think. I think the evidence isn't clear cut, and in large part it depends on the candidates and the race. So if you have a woman candidate who attempts to appeal to women voters, that may well bring up the turnout. But if it's a race where the gender of the candidate's downplayed or there's not much emphasis on that, then, in fact, you don't see that happening. And it also varies somewhat by party, you know, that and it's not so much turnout as sometimes just motivating the interest in the race. Often the interest in the race is higher, you know, when there's a woman candidate. The race receives more attention, more visibility, and, you know, and whether or not that translates into voter turnout, you know, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
Definitely. Over time, it seems to me that Susan's point is absolutely true. There was a time when a woman candidate on the ballot was a new novel thing, right? And it just didn't happen very often. And we just had this series of firsts, right? First woman governor of blah, blah, blah. First woman senator. When I was growing up in Kansas, the first woman senator in Kansas was Nancy Lyndon Kassebaum. There have been a lot of women over time, and some of the most interesting research I've seen looks at how the women candidates ultimately affect future voters in terms of encouraging and socializing women to realize that they should vote and should turn out, and what they can do, I think, is the best way to put that. But yes.
Okay. Well, and one question that often comes up is, do women block vote? So, you know, is there an advantage or a disadvantage, you know, to being a woman? And it really, I think, is a wash. There's very little evidence that women will vote for a female candidate because she's a woman. There's very little evidence that men will vote for or against a female candidate because she's a woman. What is the best predictor I think a vote choice ultimately is the partisan makeup of the electoral district in which the candidates are running.
So basically, party affiliation tends to drive a lot of the voting in the context of whether if there is a woman on the ballot or if there isn't.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
In terms of are we seeing, and Martha, you kind of mentioned this, we're seeing more and more women vying for elective offices.
Yes.
Is that a trend that is starting to gain parity in terms of in different offices, you know, federal, state, down to local level, or is there still a pretty good gap in terms of the percentage of women in the population versus the electorate versus holding actual elected office?
Right. There's still a gap. There's still a gap between the number of women in the electorate versus the number of women holding office. And that's pretty, I don't know, dramatic, maybe mm-hmm. too strong a word, but it's there is quite a gap out there. That'll close over time, I suspect. And certainly we see a lot more Republican women running for office. And certainly what we're going to be see upcoming is probably a major party candidate running for president again. Hillary Clinton is, of course, getting a lot of attention right now. But yeah, there's definitely still a gap.
Okay.
People are still taught. But women, when they run, are as likely as men to win in general terms. It's just a matter of getting women to run for office, I think. And they run when people ask.
Sure. Sure. We had talked about at the beginning the majority of North Carolina's registered voters are women. I looked at South Carolina's Election Commission website last night. Women are 55% of the registered voters in South Carolina. Susan, is that true in basically all the other states? Are women the majority of registered voters in other states across the country?
Well, certainly, I haven't done it state by state, but it's certainly true nationally. And women are also, women also are the majority of voters. And that has been true in midterm elections since 1986. You know, that women have voted they've been more than a majority, they've been a majority longer, but they've actually voted at higher rates than men in midterm elections since 1986. And in the last, nationally, in the 2010 elections, for example, because you really have to look at not the presidential election but the author election. In 2010, there were 5 million, just over 5 million more women than men who actually voted nationally. So women not only are a majority of registered voters, they're also the majority of actual voters.
Do we know why women tend to register more and tend to show up more in elections?
That's a $64,000 question. we know historically from 1920 through 1980, women voted at lower rates than men, and gradually caught up with men. Because they were given the right to vote in 1920, and gradually caught up with men by 1980. And since 1980, the trend is kind of reversed, and women have been voting at higher rates than men in presidential elections, in off-year elections, and in every election we have data for. So, why that is? I mean, part of it is increasing education rates of women, because education's correlated with voting. Part of it is, I think, the indirect message of the women's movement, not the women's movement directly, but the indirect message that has sort of helped to connect issues related to that women care about to politics, so that women see now more so, I think, than they did years and years ago, that politics has an impact on their everyday life.
We need to
lives and
We need to go to break, Susan. We greatly appreciate you joining us here this morning. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. Christopher Warren Green and the Symphony present Beethoven's Emperor Piano Concerto Thursday through Saturday. Tickets at charlottesymphony.org. And Charlotte Magazine, the October issue, features breakfast with 43 reasons not to skip this meal again. Subscriptions now available at charlottemagazine.com. Tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, each year, 400 affordable housing vouchers are released to Charlottians in need, but the demand far exceeds the supply. We'll talk to some of the people working to find housing for those who've applied for but didn't receive those vouchers. Then we turn our attention to one particular group of homeless people, LGBTQ teens whose parents have shown them the door. Where do they go? How do they survive? We'll find out when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Fed Reserve Chair Janet Yellen warns about the negative effects of economic inequality in the U.S. Debate over what the growing gap between rich and poor could mean for economic growth and political stability.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-supported 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Michael Bitzer, sitting in for Mike Collins. We appreciate Susan Carroll. Had to cut her off there at the break, but she was with the Center for American Women and Politics and at Rutgers, and we appreciate her time. We're talking about the role of women in this year's elections and their voting habits, and we're joined for the remainder of the show by Mary Klines, who is Director and Advocacy Chair for the League of Women Voters of North Carolina. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being here and looking forward to our discussion.
Good. Also joining us again is Dr. Martha Croft from UNC Charlotte and Dr. Karen Kodrowski of Winthrop University. Are you a female voter? Are you voting this year or not? Send us an email at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or if you're on Twitter, send us a tweet at WFAE or on Facebook at WFAE's Facebook page. We've got an email from Lucille saying, I have already voted. Is that, and North Carolina has already started early voting in great numbers. She says, I based my votes particularly on the issues of fairness in taxation and access to health care. Candidates who favor Medicaid expansion, which not only expands access to health care, but also creates thousands of local jobs, got her vote. Is that, I want to talk about the issues that kind of drive women voters. What do we see as kind of the core? Is there a sense of core ideas that women voters have that are particularly affecting this year's elections?
Well, there are issues that we would traditionally say are women's issues. But if you look at some of those issues, go back to what Karen said before the break, and that is that partisanship drives a lot of our vote choices. And so a lot of those issues that one might traditionally say are quote-unquote women's issues are ones that are sort of on the Democratic platform. Education, health care, children and family issues, security. There's a lot of research covering that over time. I think they vote on partisanship just like men do. I mean, this is not and a lot of the things that they look at, they see through those lenses of partisanship.
Okay. Karen?
I think it would be helpful at this point to define the gender gap, which is a phrase that always seems to be coming up around this time and with these conversations. What the gender gap means is that there is a difference in men and women's attitudes, opinions, or partisan affiliation or their vote choice greater than what you would expect. So, for example, if you had an election that was, you know, where 52% of the voters voted Republican and 48% voted Democratic, you would expect if there was no gender gap that 52% of men would have voted Republican and 52% of women would have voted Republican. A lot of people hear gender gap and say that it seems to be determinative, that women will vote more Democratic, more social issues, and that it somehow, you know, is a clearer cut position than that. Women are complex. They come across, they array themselves across the political spectrum. But what we see is that women are more likely to vote Democratic than what you would expect if there was no gender gap, and that women are more likely to favor various social welfare programs. And there's been a fair amount of, I think, discussion about what some of the reasons might be. Women are more likely to favor welfare, unemployment benefits, health care, as are as our listener had written in the email, you know, Medicaid expansions, questions like that. And the belief is that women may perceive that they are more likely to someday need those services, and therefore they are more likely to support them. They are less likely to support tax cuts, interestingly enough, and they are much less motivated by gun rights, which are sort of, when you think about this in a partisan sense, more Republican mm-hmm. issues.
Mary, your organization, the League of Women Voters, mm-hmm. is a nonpartisan organization, but y'all look at these issues and try to increase women's participation in voting and being educated on these policy concerns. How does your organization look at this year's issues?
Yeah, the League of Women Voters is based on a number of things. First off, let me just reiterate, it is nonpartisan, but it is political. And that's kind of hard for people to separate.
How can something be nonpartisan but political?
Political. Well, it depends. I think most of life is political. So on voting is the entry point for women into the political process in most cases. The suffragists recognized that when the 19th Amendment was passed in 1920. Now, that was a 72-year fight for women to get the vote. And out of that movement came the League of Women Voters to educate women about the issues, as we're talking about. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to vote? Why should you vote? Why does it matter? Why should you pay attention? Because public policy in this case impacts our life all the time, much more than probably most of us realize. So the entry point into that civic political process is voting for most people. Most people, women and men, are not going to run for office for a lot of different right. reasons. But most people should and need to vote to make their voice heard.
And so y'all look at specific policies, y'all look at
educating. We do a number of things. Okay. And in this case, the League of Women Voters, right at this point in time, is very focused on what we call voter service and voter education. As an example, with the new laws that have been passed here in North Carolina, there's quite a few changes come mm-hmm. down. All of a sudden, people are going to have to adjust their habits. So we are part of a national program actually called Voter Protection. We are educating throughout the state because we have chapters from Dare County to Macon County. We're educating the public, not just women, but the public on what those law changes mean and how do you have to alter your process and your thinking about voting. And, of course, we come to our traditional candidates form and voter guides. And let me just put in a little plug here.
Okay.
The Charlotte League of Women Voters just finished the candidate debates with WTVI. So if voters will log on to WTVI.org or GoLeagueGo.org, they can listen to the debates, watch the debates. There's plenty of voter information there. So that's a good example right here in Charlotte. Okay. Of what the League of Women Voters does.
Okay. Certainly those forums, those candidate forums, those candidate debates provide a lot of information. Another way of getting a lot of information that we are seeing, particularly here in North Carolina, is through advertising. And the projections are $100 million being spent on the U.S. Senate race between Democrat Kay Hagan and Republican Tom Tillis. Most of these $100 million has been going to these TV ads. But the ads seem to feature the battle for the female vote as well. We've got two clips of two ads that I want to air. Here's an ad from Tom Tillis attacking Kay Hagan, and specifically listen to the voices in this ad.
It's extremely important that North Carolina elects a senator that was willing to think independently and vote for North Carolina.
Tom Tillis is a strong leader. He's willing to tackle big issues.
I think it says a lot that people can't think what Kay Hagan has accomplished.
She's a nice woman, but she is not an effective senator.
It's plain and simple. Kay Hagan talks, Tom Tillis does.
Kay Hagan is not getting the job done.
NRSC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
All women voices in that ad. Now, The question is, who is the NRSC? Karen?
National Republican Senatorial Committee, which is a major fundraising organization that funnels money to Republican Senate candidates. And there are Democratic counterparts to this and a Republican counterpart at the House level and at the Senate level.
So. It seems like some of these ads have women featured in them, women speaking about the issues. Is that deliberative in this year's campaign? Are the Tillis and the Hagan campaign really taking this to heart and utilizing it as their messaging focus?
Oh, most definitely, because we know that women are going to be key to this election in particular, getting them out to vote. So I suppose the political marketers think that women appeal to other women. And especially the Republicans, who on the Democratic side of the rhetoric are having a war on women, particularly in regards to birth control and some other issues. I think the Republicans feel perhaps that they need to try to counter that image. Mm-hmm. No, we aren't having a war on women. Look at all the women that support the Republican Party.
Okay. And Kay Hagan has made this campaign about education, about health care, certainly two issues that certainly appeal to women. And here's an ad from a third-party surrogate group. And again, listen for the name of that group at the end of this particular ad.
My name is Hope.
Hallie.
Betty.
Jacqueline.
Callie.
Shanice.
Healthcare is personal.
But for Tom Tillis, women's health care is just politics.
As Speaker, he passed sweeping abortion restrictions,
threatening nearly all of North Carolina's health care clinics for women.
And he defunded Planned Parenthood.
Tillis opposes affordable access to even basic health care,
like mammograms and cancer screenings.
Tom Tillis, we don't need you making our health care decisions.
Women Vote is responsible for the content of his advertising.
Women Vote Project is part of Emily's List. Who is Emily's List?
Emily's List is an organization that for a long time has supported and tried to get women candidates who are pro-choice elected. So they bundle contributions, that is to say they get people to donate to them, and then they will funnel those donations to those are women that are pro-choice.
Okay.
Democratic women. Okay. Pro-choice. Yeah, it is a partisan organization. I think the content of that ad is worth commenting on. So first, it talks a lot about reproductive choice. It talks about women's clinics. Those are all sort of code words for abortion supporters, for those who support legalized abortion. Interestingly enough, when you look at public opinion polls, there is a clear gender gap on the issue of abortion. However, men are more likely to favor legalized abortion than are women.
Why? Do we know why?
Why?
I mean,
no,
it just seems
don't.
Like
do
it.
Do you have any good ideas? But what I think is very interesting, though, is that for Democratic women who are very politically active, abortion, of course, has been a key organizing tool. And I think it keeps coming up in that this whole bit about the ironic state of public opinion, I guess, is kind of interesting. But the women who are very active in the pro-choice movement are going to be giving money. They are going to be mobilizing. They're going to be especially mobilizing young women at the height of their fertility who might care very deeply about these kinds of issues. Interestingly enough, you also find that breast cancer got paired in there as well, which is clearly a women's health issue that transcends age, it transcends ideology, it transcends religious preferences and things like that. One very clear strategy that has been coming out is to link those two, because especially now in pink month, October, you know, we're hearing nothing. The breast cancer is the thing that everybody can hate, and it's the women's issue that everybody can get behind. And so by linking those, that's a very astute strategy in terms of talking about women's health and deflecting it away from the much more contentious issue about abortion.
Interesting. Mary, the League of Women Voters sent out a, I guess, for lack of a better term, a questionnaire to both Kay Hagan and to Tom Tillis, asked about five different policy areas: the Voting Rights Amendment Act, the Disclose Act, the Affordable Care Act. Senator Hagan responded. Speaker Tillis did not. Is that traditional? Is that typical for one side to respond to your group's questionnaire and the other one not? Or
What? You know, I wouldn't say it's typical.
Okay.
It does happen, excuse me, regrettably, but it is not, I wouldn't call it typical at all. I think it shortchanges, excuse me, when that happens, the public is shortchanged.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't have the answers, they don't have the information. We put a lot of thought into the questions. Takes a lot of time to formulate questions that are mm-hmm. fair, open, give the candidates an opportunity to respond on an issue in any way that they choose. So when a candidate chooses not to respond, I think that's regrettable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not traditional, but it does happen.
You find most of all candidates that you survey do respond?
Yes.
I
think most of them welcome it, because I think the League of Women Voters, we are very respected. We're well known. And we make tremendous efforts in our voter service to be as transparent and open, give opportunity for candidates to tell the voters where they stand on the issues. And that's the important part of a voter education project.
Okay. We talked briefly about the gender gap in most of the public opinion polls that most recently have come out. For example, yesterday, the New York Times and YouGov, Hagen leads among women 47 to 38. In a Survey USA poll, Hagen was leading, by 11 among women. Is that the typical division? Do we see that kind of double-digit lead for Democrats among women voters as opposed to male voters, or is something going on this year that it's even more pronounced?
That's, the pattern is quite common. I would say that that's a very large magnitude.
Could that decide the election?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yes.
Okay. We've got a comment from Jane on Facebook. I'm a white female, over 65 voter. I almost always vote Democratic. And if there's a woman running, I research her background. I think she makes a good candidate. We'll vote for her. I think women bring a different set of qualities to the table and are sorely needed in this divisive political scene. Do women bring different qualities and characteristics when they marry? You're wanting
yes.
to talk about that.
I love this question.
Okay.
Because I brought along a book that I use for references, and it has a quote from Madeleine Albright on that. And it's just, if I may read it. It's
just
short.
Very briefly, yeah.
If women in government do their jobs, they will improve the lot of women and girls everywhere. They will raise issues others overlook, pass bills others oppose, put money into projects others ignore, and seek an end to abuses others accept.
Interesting. Karen? Yeah,
I think Madeleine Albright hit the nail on the head. One thing that we see that's different about women as elected officials from their male counterparts is that they bring different issues to the agenda. So their vote on a final legislative product might be best predicted by their party. However, the conversation is different because different issues are on the table.
One more thing to mention as well is I know that there's ongoing research, but we could look at one anecdote. When the government was shut down, the big thing going around was that the women members of Congress, the senators, they got together, Republicans and Democrats, to talk to try and find a solution.
That's Dr. Martha Kropp from UNC Charlotte, joined by Dr. Karen Kodrowski from Winthrop University. And Mary Kleins from the League of Women Voters. We will take a short break. Send us an email if you are a female voter and tell us what's on your mind for this year's midterm elections. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer.
Michael.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and McCall Center for Art and Innovation, celebrating a 15-year anniversary with a new exhibition by Merrick Ranis, Arctic Utopia, now through November 22nd. Details at McCallCenter.org. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, the risks of income inequality. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen warns about the negative effects of income inequality. Diane Rehm and a panel of experts will talk about what the growing gap between the rich and poor may mean for economic growth and political stability in the U.S. That's coming up at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, next here on 90.7 WFAE. If you'd like to join Charlotte Talks today, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook and Twitter.
You know, I drive junky cars.
Hello, this is Nina Totenberg.
When my husband and I were courting, he was really scandalized by my very old Mazda 626. And when we were invited to a state dinner at the White House, he said that I should rent a fancier car. I refused, of course. It's amazing to think that I could turn that dumpy car into my favorite programs.
Call 1-866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
We're back with Mary Klins. I'm sorry, I've been mispronouncing your name, but she is with the League of Women Voters of North Carolina. Joining us also is Dr. Karen Kodrowski from Winthrop University and Martha Croft from UNC Charlotte. We've been talking about the issues, reactions that women have in terms of voting. Mary, you had wanted to bring up about the issues that resonate with female voters.
Yes, and we were talking earlier about the female voice resonating more with female voters. And the State League is a member of a coalition called North Carolina Women Matter. And it part of the project is to get women out to vote, talking about the issues that matter to them. And we do a letter writing campaign, woman to woman. I vote, please, will you vote? And Angela sent me a copy of the letter she sent. And she talked about the issues. And I thought this was appropriate. Angela says to whoever she's writing to, "I'm writing to you wearing many hats. Wife, mother, grandmother, senior citizen, breast cancer and lung cancer survivor, healthcare worker, and voter." And so then she goes on in her letter to talk about the issues that matter to her. And in this case, it's education, women's safety, women and children's health. So that is Angela writing to another woman on issues that are important to her and why she thinks other women, in this case, should pay attention to the issues.
Is that kind of outreach, effective in terms of mobilizing and energizing in terms of voter turnout?
I definitely think that if you look at the research, the thing that we know is personalized contact matters the most. If you can establish a connection with someone and try and get them to vote, not just a candidate, but face-to-face contact, letting someone know what you expect, they're going to go out and do probably what you expect if it's a societal duty like voting, especially.
Okay. All right. We saw over the weekend Hillary Clinton come to Charlotte to campaign on behalf of Kay Hagan in a very close competitive election here for the U.S. Senate seat. Martha, you were there.
Oh, I was.
At the rally. What was the feeling? What were the kind of issues, the themes that both Senator Hagan and Secretary Clinton hit on? Did those work directly to an appeal to the female voter?
Oh, definitely. Equal pay for equal work was a big one, and women's health. But equal pay for equal work, I was surprised at the number of times that came up at that rally, and from both candidates. And I think that's something that we haven't really talked about so much here, because I think that in principle, Democratic voters are going to support that. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that was striking to me, or that I observed when I was looking at this rally, was the idea of how the presentation of themselves, of Kay Hagan and of Hillary Clinton. For example, Secretary Clinton worked very hard she didn't work very hard, but she did talk about her lovely grandchild.
Who happens to be named?
Carolina.
Charlotte, I think.
Charlotte.
Yeah.
Charlotte.
Goodness
gracious.
Close.
Sorry, yeah. And she opened and closed with that, right?
Oh, did she?
But the whole middle part was the tough issues, the North Carolina is not for sale sort of rhetoric that the Democrats have been hitting on this well as this year, and especially with this idea that they know that they have been outspent in general. I mean, Americans for Prosperity have been in since, what, January-ish or even earlier this year. I mean, the ads from the outside groups have been earlier than I have ever seen any ads before. And again, as you pointed out at the beginning, a record-setting amount of money spent in North Carolina. So she opened and closed with a sort of presentation of herself as in her pantsuit, by the way, just to make that clear, and with Hagan in her red skirt suit, right, that they presented themselves as tough but feminine. And so the real question is, and I think there's a professor actually at Davidson College who I heard her give a talk about this. Dr. Nicole Bauer was giving a talk about how should a woman present herself, a woman candidate. And her experimental research suggested that women should be tough and assertive and use that kind of language. Of course, experiments, really? Yes. Yeah. And actually, I certainly, this is arguable. Experimental research has its issues. What are some interesting research showing that women, that in her work, voters didn't hold it against women candidates for them to be tough and assertive? And I think over the last 20 years that I've been in political science, that's something that's been quite a debate, how women should present themselves and should they talk about their grandchildren.
How is Nikki Haley? She came in as kind of an underdog 4 years ago and captured the party's nomination and then got into a kind of battle with the General Assembly in South Carolina. How has she been able to navigate all that?
Well, in terms of her, she is up for reelection this year, and she will be reelected handily. The Winthrop poll, which came out a few weeks ago, shows that she's up well over 10 points over her opponent, or about 10 points over her opponent. Interestingly enough, she uses a rhetorical strategy where she frequently talks about her mother and her family and her children and her own role as a mother and how she cares about South Carolina families. But then she morphs that into, I care about South Carolina families by bringing in jobs. So it becomes an economic development argument. She has also been referred to as Teflon Nikki, in part because even though there have been some pretty horrendous scandals at the Department of Social Services with the deaths of something like 300 children and some severe budget cuts and overloaded caseworkers and so forth.
And you had the hacking issue.
And then there was the hacking with the with the tax revenue office, that these things she has managed to deflect. They have not seemed to have politically harmed her. And now, of course, she is able to talk about fixing DSS, bringing in and allowing them to, you know, supporting hiring additional caseworkers and staff and increasing the budget and so forth. So she, I think, uses an effective rhetorical strategy where she does not run from her femininity or her position as a woman. She's very silent on her position as a minority. She does not talk about that as she talks about being a wife and a mother and someone who cares about South Carolina families.
Is there, and that raises an interesting question about diving into women voters and women candidates. Are there differences within female voters and candidates, particularly when it comes to race? When you go from a white female candidate to a minority, other racial minority candidate, are there differences within that in terms of how they appeal to voters, where they look at, what their issues are, differences in terms of color within female voters?
Well, I think that's actually, if you think about this idea, it's intersectionality. How does a person navigate the issues of race and gender, a voter, both a voter and a candidate? And when you take a look at that, it makes things a lot more complicated. But in North Carolina, it's particularly interesting simply because of the history in North Carolina. While not as bad as some southern states, there's certainly some civil rights issues at play here. And with the election reforms that were passed by the state election changes, reforms that were passed last summer by the state legislature, you certainly see some of those issues about voter identification, photo ID, and other issues like that at play. And certainly, this is something that the League of Women Voters obviously has played a great role in. But African-American women do have some very unique concerns that I would say perhaps a white woman does not have or has not experienced.
Right. Or an African-American man.
Okay.
An African-American man, yes.
Yeah. Mary, how does your organization, the League of Women Voters, approach this issue?
Well, I think what I would add to this conversation is it's not as easy as it should be or appears to be to access the information. I'm going back to the voters now rather mm-hmm. than the candidate. It seems to probably most of us sitting here at this dais and maybe many of the listeners that, oh, this is just real easy to do. Why don't people do it more? But it isn't. We've talked to people for so many years on just the registration process. Why is it so cumbersome compared to other places? Now the new voting laws are, from the League of Women Voters standpoint, making it even harder to vote, putting up more barriers. So how can people, I think what the League brings to this whole discussion is a platform where voters, people can enter the process, get the information, make their decisions on their own. No, we're not telling anybody who to vote for. We're telling them how to vote, where to vote, why it matters.
Okay. Speaking of voting, this year, of course, we're about to wrap up the midterms. We're going to start the election cycle for 2016, probably the night of November 4th, once we get all the winners declared. Speaking of Secretary Hillary Clinton, if she chooses to run for the Democratic presidential nomination, having run 6 years ago, what lessons did she learn that she may need to consider for a bid in 2016? Is that going to be kind of the big issue? And again, are we going to see this issue of women voters and women candidates facing 2016 presidential?
I would say one of the first lessons that she has learned is to not take anything for granted. And secondly, don't spend your money too quickly. When I talk with my colleagues across the country who lived through the 2008 presidential elections, I had students at Winthrop University who were employed as workers for the Clinton campaign because she spent an enormous amount of money in the early contests. And South Carolina was privileged to have that. As the campaign dragged on, she ran out of money. She had tapped out her major donors, and she was not able to replicate the kind of organization that she had in South Carolina, in other states, where she had a better shot of winning the primary eventually. Okay. So I think those are two lessons.
Okay. Martha?
I think the best way to put this is that she will have to imitate Obama's on-the-ground mobilization if she expects to win the election in 2016. I mean, I certainly would think we could have an interesting conversation about what the Republican challengers are, mm-hmm. Who the potential Democratic challengers are for her. But in general, Obama's on-the-ground mobilization was unprecedented.
Right. We have a tweet from James on Twitter. I'm a retired guy. I always vote for women because they are more sincerely interested in, quote, people issues, unquote, like education and health care. Is that going to be something that Secretary Clinton could potentially use to her advantage to not just attract female voters, but male voters as well? Or is it because Democrats vote for Democrats, Republicans vote for Republicans?
So I think when people see a woman's name on the ballot, no matter her partisanship, they assume that she's going to be more interested in people issues. And this guy, James,
a retired guy,
I respect that he uses that as sort of his heuristic. I'm glad he's voting, but I think it's a mistake to assume that all women candidates Republican or Democrat are going to have some of the same views. Mm-hmm. And I would think that I think if you'd voted for, say, judges based on that heuristic of a woman sounding name, it would certainly get a different character and class of women, depending on if they're more Republican or more liberal or conservative.
Interesting. Mary.
Yes. On this issue, we have the League of Women Voters is for men also. And our men, our membership, it's a membership-based organization, mm-hmm. And more men are joining the League of Women. Not enough, but a good number. And I have had men say to me, I joined the League of Women Voters before my wife joined. And I joined because the League of Women Voters wants to make change. And we take that as a compliment. And so there's a lot of interplay going on here and maybe some stereotypes getting changed.
Sure. Mary, you're from a nonpartisan group, so I'm not going to direct this question to you, but I want to get our experts here, Martha and Karen. Any predictions? Karen, you alluded to the South Carolina gubernatorial contest between Nikki Haley and State Senator Vincent Shaheen. Your Winthrop poll says Nikki's going to walk away. Governor Haley's going to walk away with this.
And in terms of the outcomes, you know, we're expecting a Republican sweep of the statewide races and probably six of the seven congressional races, which is bad news for many of the women on the ballot since they are disproportionately Democratic candidates.
Martha?
Well, I think the North
Carolina. In North Carolina, yeah.
I think it's definitely a toss-up. I think if the Hagan campaign can succeed in getting women to turn out, and particularly African-American women and minorities more generally, in the same way that Obama has for his presidential runs, although it's a midterm, then she has a fighting chance. But I think it's anybody's game at this point.
With a week to go.
Wishy-washy. Yeah, I'm going to be wishy-washy.
Okay. Well, we are heading into the home stretch. I want to thank all of our guests here, Dr. Karen Kodrowski from Winthrop University, Dr. Martha Croft from UNC Charlotte, Mary Klins from the League of Women Voters of North Carolina. We greatly appreciate it. If I can say to both men, women and men, please vote early or on election day, but just go vote. Thanks for listening. This is Michael Bitzer sitting in for Mike Collins, and this has been Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.